22-1017, Kazi. I'm probably mangled all the pronunciations today. I think I can get KFC correctly. Mr. Weiss.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your
Good morning, Your Honors. Dan Weiss on behalf of the appellant. May it please the court, I'll be focusing my remarks on the contract portion of the issues raised on our appeal. I'm happy to answer questions on any subject matter, but I expect with time limitations, I'll have a lot to say about the contractual issues. That's because, Your Honors, from our perspective, the case begins and ends with the unambiguous terms of the contract, the franchise agreement, which require judgment as a matter of law for KFC. As we know from the very first principles in law school and in the case law, the unambiguous terms of a contract are for the court to enforce. They're not a jury issue. They're for the court to enforce. In this case, the district court failed to enforce the unambiguous terms of the franchise agreement. Instead, the district court put the case to the jury for an assessment of subjective motivations, beliefs, non-contractual documents in the forms of the guidelines, which the district court itself found were not part of the party's contract. That was error.
Would you conceptualize the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing as an add-on provision to the franchise agreement? Is that the best way to think about this, or is it something different?
What I would say, Your Honor, is that under Kentucky law, under even the most plaintiff-friendly articulation of the implied covenant, what the covenant says is that you can't deprive another party of the benefit of the bargain as originally intended between the parties. When you have an unambiguous contract, that's how you determine what the benefit of the bargain is. You look at the contract. And the Kentucky cases tell us over and over that the implied covenant will not override unambiguous contractual terms. So, for example, the Old Henry case from 2021, which we cite in the brief, provides a party cannot be deemed to have broken its implied duty of good faith and fair dealing by taking acts permitted by the contract. The Farmers Bank case from the Kentucky Supreme Court provides the implied covenant doesn't prevent a party from exercising its contractual rights. In all of the case law, the Kentucky courts are very careful to always ground the implied covenant in the terms of the contract. It goes back to what the bargain was between the parties. It isn't a free-floating, have you acted in a fair way? It's have you deprived someone of the bargain that's represented in the unambiguous terms of the contract between the parties.
Do you think the PBI bank case is consistent with that precedent?
It's what I would say, Your Honor, and that's certainly the case that the plaintiff relies on most heavily. PBI case contains the quotation that about the bargain originally intended between the parties. There are three cases decided under Kentucky law involving banks foreclosing on properties that seem to have a little bit of a special application of good faith and fair dealing. And so I would put those outside of the main run of the cases, of the commercial cases. PBI was a case about a foreclosure where the bank did something underhanded during the foreclosure. It essentially foreclosed on a property and then sold the property at a profit the very next day. There's two other cases that are very similar in Kentucky law.
What happened to that appeal after the State Court of Appeals ruled as it did? Was there any further history in that case?
In the PBI case?
Yes.
Your Honor, I believe in our brief we point out that there was a petition up to the State Supreme Court, but then there was a settlement.
Was it granted by the State Court?
I don't know, Your Honor. I could submit that in a letter. I just don't know well enough to represent to the court.
I thought there was something saying Supreme Court actually granted
discretionary. I believe that that's correct.
And then the party settled.
I believe that that's correct, Your Honor. I believe that's correct.
I think that's got to affect our view of the persuasive authority of that case.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. And consistent with the other cases that we cited, Old Henry, Farmers Bank, the Jones case, the Kentucky cases tell us over and over that the implied covenant is not going to rewrite the contract. That's what happened here. So very briefly, what the contract provides is in Section 3.6, the franchisee takes a license to KFC's intellectual property. It can use the recipes, the name, the colors, and all of that material, but only exclusively within a 1.5 mile zone. That is the bargain for zone of protection under the contract, a 1.5 mile radius. Section 19 then goes on to tell us that KFC will be licensing new outlets that could be close to the existing outlet, and in that circumstance, the franchisee's recourse is a right of first offer to operate the new outlet. And that's all. There are no other restrictions or protections provided in the contract. And in fact, the contract in 4 or 5 different provisions goes out of its way to say there are no promises other than those contained in this contract. We cited.
Could I just ask you?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are there franchise cases that say it makes a difference, and would it make a difference here, whether the franchise agreement explicitly reserved a right for KFC to locate franchises nearby but outside the 1.5-mile radius?
Your Honor, I think there are a number of cases in the area, and it may be possible to find a case that says that, but the vast majority of the cases do not say that, Your Honor. And I would point, Your Honor, to the Weaver decision from the 11th Circuit, which says that when you provide words describing the territory. In that case, there was no exclusive territory. Then the other side of the coin, it's two sides of a coin. You have a protected territory, and then you have an unprotected territory, and you don't need to reserve the unprotected territory. That's implicit in the protected area itself. In addition, we have here Section 19, which I think is unique among the franchise cases. So I don't think in those other cases, which largely do go the way of the franchisor, they didn't have the additional fact that we have here, which is an expressly contemplated procedure for licensing new restaurants outside the 1.5 mile territory, which was followed here. So KFC followed Section 3.6, which is the 1.5 miles, and it followed Section 19 by offering a right of first offer to the plaintiff, which the plaintiff turned down.
Well, but then KFC permitted him to commission an impact study, which the company went on to do. And, you know, that Section 19 notice does, it appears to give the franchisee, you know, some additional rights and procedures, i.e., right of first refusal or an impact study. And if the impact study shows an impact above, 15%, there would be that KFC would not authorize a new restaurant. Less than 10% option approved, I guess, new restaurant approved. 10 to 15% further review, more than 15% option denied. Why aren't those provisions and that process part of the deal that you have with Mr. Cassie?
Yes, Your Honor. They're not contractual. They are an offer. They're a guideline that KFC announced as to how it was going to approach these situations. But in the end, they're not contractual. And we know they're not contractual because the district court found that they were not contractual. And the plaintiff did not appeal that holding out of the district court. The contract sets up a whole process for amending the contract. It has requirements in terms of who will sign documents. And it explicitly says that statements outside of the contract are not binding on KFC. There's integration clauses. There's 5 or 6 different clauses that tell franchisees that things that are not in the contract are not part of the contract. There's also a timing aspect here, which may not have been fully apparent in the briefing, which is that the guidelines were announced in November of 2016, prior to the signature of the franchise agreement in this case. So the guidelines are announced as a company policy in November of 2016, and the plaintiff signs a new franchise agreement in June of 2017, which contains all of these clauses saying that things not in the contract are not part of the contract.
What's the purpose of it then if you have unbridled discretion outside of 1.5 miles? Is that your interpretation?
In terms of...
Does KFC have unbridled discretion to open a new restaurant outside of 1.5 miles, subject to the right of first refusal?
KFC has discretion, but it is bound by the contract, so it's not unbridled. It's bound by 1.5 miles. If you, you know, geometrically draw franchises with 1.5 mile radii around them, you have a limited number of stores that you could open in a perfect geographical world, which, of course, doesn't exist. So there's a limit to the discretion there, and then there's a limit to the discretion.
Well, the
with
limit
Section
to the
19.
Discretion is in terms of the contract, or just as a practical matter. I mean, what if KFC licensed multiple franchises 2 miles away from the Kazi franchise? Wouldn't that violate the covenant of good faith and fair dealing?
Well, it wouldn't be able to, Your Honor, just as a practical matter, under the bargain the parties struck, because you have these 1.5 mile circles around each outlet that's placed. You wind up mathematically with 3 miles distance between each of the franchises, and that's only if you could fit them in a perfect model, which you can't because of lakes and mountains and things like that. So there's a practical limitation, but it's not just fighting with the hypothetical. It is the contract. It's the bargain the party struck. There's only a limited number of restaurants that could ever be built nearby, and the right of first offer also limits the discretion, limits the ability of KFC to do something like what Your Honor described. But in the end, at bottom, the contract is the contract, and KFC is able to enforce its rights completely under the contract. As the Jones case tells us, and let me quote from it, because it's I think exactly on point. It provides, it is not a function of this court to change obligations of a contract which the parties have made, nor to add a condition which was not written into the original contract. The Jones case is a case involving discretion. It's a loan. There's a high and a low cap on the interest rate. And the plaintiff says good faith and fair dealing requires you to make adjustments between those two things. The Jones Court of Appeals 2017 says no. There's no obligation here to adjust the rate. The bank's not required to adjust it. The parties set the boundaries, and then within that boundary, that's for the bank to decide, and it rejects the claim as a matter of law.
Could I just ask, going back to the point you were making a minute or two ago, the date of the guidelines was 2016, the date of the franchise agreement applicable here is 2019. I'm just wondering if that, at least arguably, could cut the other way. That is, the guidelines are there as a backdrop to the new franchise agreement. Why wouldn't that support the implied covenant argument that Kazi is trying to make here?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the clauses in the contract which explicitly say the contract supersedes all prior and contemporaneous understandings. So this would be, if this were just a contract case, this would be a black and white case where somebody was coming in with an off-contract document saying, I thought this was the deal. But the deal says the contract supersedes all prior and contemporaneous understandings. It's very simple. It also says no statements outside of the contract are binding on KFC unless they're in this agreement. That's Section 2. It's pretty crystal clear that you can't rely on anything that's outside of the contract.
How sophisticated is Mr. Kazi?
The evidence at trial, Your Honor, was that Mr. Kazi has owned hundreds of KFC restaurants. He currently owns somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 50 KFC restaurants. Your Honors, I'd like to reserve a little bit of time for rebuttal. So with Your Honor's permission, I'll take my seat. Thank you.
Good morning. Bruce Rohde for Appley Kazi. May it please the Court. I'd like to make a couple of points regarding damages and the jury instruction and then move into the implied covenant. I don't intend to address potential certification to the Kentucky Supreme Court or mistrial unless, of course, the court wants to. With respect to damages, I would like to emphasize that we had a stipulation negotiated over a period of days between Mr. Weiss and Mr. Britton here where not only did we stipulate that our damage expert, Mr. Opp's numbers could come in, but that we could request the award set out in Opp's opinions and papers from the jury. And what does such a request mean if now when the jury grants the request and makes the award, it can be challenged? The stipulation was all about duration. We agreed to cap our damages at, I think it was 2031, which was a negotiated point. So the idea that now we can challenge...
The year 2031.
Yes, yes. Thank you, Your Honor. Ironically, the stipulation was made to avoid evidentiary issues regarding foundation and sufficiency and streamlining our damages case, but here we are. With respect to the jury instruction, of course, the federal standard, federal rules of procedure govern whether an instruction is given, but state law governs the nature of the instruction, and Kentucky has what's called the bare bones rule, that the instruction need only be sufficient to guide the juries in applying the law correctly. That's out of PBI Bank. And that they be substantially correct. And that they should not be condemned as prejudicial unless calculated to mislead the jury. And according to, I believe, a correct application of that standard, the instruction the court gave regarding the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing clearly passes the test. I can tell you where it came from. It came from the Combs case that KFC relied on and Combs's expansive definition of good faith and fair dealing. Okay, good faith. As a quick aside, we're not supposed to be citing and relying on unpublished decisions like the O. Henry case that was just discussed at some length. When there are published opinions, and here, as the court knows, there are many that address the issue. Nevertheless, KFC relies on several published opinions. You know, when I read all the cases again last week, gosh, there's over 40 of them, I think, and over the weekend, what really resonated with me, that at bottom, good faith is all about protecting reasonable expectations. And when you read the cases with that in mind and ask yourself the question, could the complaining party really have reasonably expected the performance he is complaining of? They really fall into place, including the bank cases. And including the franchisee cases.
You know, one case that's not based on Kentucky law is the Little Caesars case. What do you think the fatal flaw in that reasoning is?
I'm glad you asked that. I think another, when the dust cleared a little bit in reading all these cases, things that occurred to me about the franchise cases, Little Caesars, the two McDonald's cases, and the Burger King case, they are not about impact. None of them. They're all about exclusivity, including Little Caesars, who complain that, wait a minute, you, Little Caesars promised that I'd get this territory, and now you've put a Little Caesars in there, anyway. But there, it was not an impact-based case, nor the McDonald's cases, Judge Matheson, that you referred to, specifically provide that, like with KFC, you've got an exclusive territory, but unlike KFC, we McDonald's can go into your exclusive territory if we want to. They spell out these rights. And the Burger King v. Weaver case is a very instructive case because the court points out the kind of provision you needed to have in your franchise agreement, which in that court's view would have adequately tethered, as they'd like to say, the implied covenant to the contract. And what do they say that provision would be? An exclusive territory provision, which we have in our franchise agreement.
What in the contract gives your client a right to challenge a disfavored impact on his franchise outside the 1.5 exclusive zone?
The implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing and reasonable expectations.
Doesn't KFC, that have to be tethered to a contract?
KFC sends my client this letter saying you have a right of first offer and a right to...
Is that a contract, though?
That's a tether. If this isn't a tether, the franchisor sending you the opportunity to, if you want to pay for it, have an impact study to inform its decision of whether or not it's going to actually license a new outlet, and telling you the guidelines that it's going to follow if you...
So you're saying that's part of the franchise agreement.
I'm saying that it informs... I'm saying that Judge Jackson got it absolutely correct when he said that this shows us what KFC thought good faith and fair dealing looked
like. Didn't he dismiss the breach of contract claim, though?
Yes, because he respected the four corners argument. Was KFC performing according to the express terms of the contract? Of course it was.
Doesn't the implied covenant then have to be tethered to some contractual agreement?
And it was.
It's
Section 19.
Guidelines.
Section 19, as they say themselves.
You're making that letter, in effect, a contract. You're buying it. But, I mean, I think you have a good argument that it is a contract. But that's not an issue before us. And you're not arguing that there was promissory estoppel or something. There are lots of arguments that could be made based on that letter, but they weren't made, or they're abandoned. And they have a right to do what they want outside of 1.5 miles.
Not an unbridled right, as Justice Scalia put it when he was Judge Scalia, as this course cited and quoted him in the Flood v. Clear One case, but to say that every expressly conferred contractual power amounts to disavowing any implied covenant is virtually to read the doctrine of good faith out of existence. I can't say it any better than that.
That brings us really back to full circle, whether you can plead, allege a standalone independent cause of action for breach of good faith and fair dealing without, that comes back to my first question. Isn't it an implied term in a contract versus some, brooding, mystical, theory of relief?
Yes. And as I was trying to say earlier, of course KFC is performing under its contract. It's exercising its right to open a new outlet beyond our exclusive territory. But as I think the court explained well in the Club Systems case, it's not whether you're exercising your rights, it's how. And KFC itself announced how it would and should exercise its discretionary right.
Counsel,
it is not unbridled.
Could I just ask, in terms of your reasonable expectations argument, first of all, am I correct to take that to mean reasonable expectations is another way of saying what the implied covenant is?
Yes, the implied covenant at bottom is to protect reasonable expectations. And here, unlike in any of the other cases, we don't have...
Well, let me just get the rest of the question out.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So, are reasonable expectations in this context, is this purely a matter of contract interpretation? Is it purely a matter of law? Or is there any factual determination that needs to be made as to reasonable expectations?
Yes.
The reason I'm asking that is that we have here the district court first addresses these issues in the context of a Rule 12b6 motion, But then we have a trial, and jury instruction six somewhat incorporates the district court's analysis at that point. And then we have the post-trial motions and so forth. And I guess what I'm asking is in assessing your reasonable expectations argument, do we ignore the evidence presented at trial? Is it strictly a matter of looking at the contract and maybe the guidelines, or is there something else that we're supposed to be doing to address your argument?
No, of course you look at the surrounding facts and circumstances. It'd be one thing if we had a contract that, like many of them, where the implied covenant claim failed, that expressly addresses the situation and defines do's and don'ts regarding the opening of new outlets, or expressly gives the franchisor complete and absolute discretion, regardless of impact or adverse consequence. But in the absence of that, no. You're starting with the contract, of course, and seeing if it has such do's and don'ts or parameters, which we don't have here. And then you're looking at all the relevant circumstances. Here, most notably, the guidelines, unlike any other case cited in the briefs, but other surrounding circumstances at all. We would have had a bad faith claim even in the absence of the guidelines. And there are, of course, many cases where such claims are lodged, all of them, in the absence of express guidelines such as we have here. So, yes, Judge Matheson, we look at all the relevant surrounding circumstances, sometimes commercial reasonableness and behavior, all as discussed by Williston, a treatise cited almost uniformly in all the Kentucky cases that seems to ground their respective decisions. Sometimes behavior of the parties, previous behavior of the parties with respect to the matter at hand, or not necessarily with each other, but say the franchisor's dealings and behavior with other franchisees. All the relevant circumstances come into play to try to discern reasonable expectations.
Let me put it in a slightly different way. Did the district court put any part of reasonable expectations to the jury, for the jury to decide as a factual matter? What was a reasonable expectation?
Yes. I think that's in its jury instruction. And that's what the jury did. And I think there's probably little doubt that the jury relied heavily on the guidelines on defining Kazi's reasonable expectations. After all, KFC sends him this letter and tells him what to expect. He pays timely.
Can you reasonably rely on the guidelines when the contract says we're not bound by anything outside this contract?
Yes.
Why is it reasonable to say that the contract?
Because it doesn't say, it doesn't prohibit. It doesn't say.
It says nothing, we're not bound by anything except what's in the language of this contract. Is it reasonable to rely on something outside the contract in that context?
Well, I circle back to Justice Scalia in that. That kind of reasoning, respectfully, Your Honor, would read the implied covenant out of existence. Here we have
I can give you examples of where that would happen. I'm not going to take your time now because you've got 6 seconds left. But go ahead and wrap it up quickly.
No, thank you, Your Honor.
Well, that's clear. Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted.
Counselor, you've got some rebuttal.
Oh.
I apologize.
Thank
no,
you.
It's
thank
okay,
you.
Your Honor. I'll
see, he told me he should have been presiding today. He's demonstrated he's correct.
I promise to be very brief, but also it's a minute 23, so I will definitely be very brief. I'll try to make 3 points very briefly in response to the questions Your Honor's just asked. First of all, this is a pure matter of law. This is interpreting an unambiguous contract. Courts do that all the time as a matter of law at Rule 12, at Rule 56. There's been this notion raised that the contract is silent with respect to new franchises. That's just not true. Section 3.6 tells you the territory. Section 19 tells you there will be new franchises. And here's the process by which you can make an offer if you'd like to use them. There was a lot of discussion of reasonable expectations, but this is extremely important. The Kentucky cases don't ask, hey, what are your reasonable expectations? They look to the contract to define the party's expectations. If the contract is unambiguous, that's how courts determine what the party's expectations are. And so here, when the plaintiff says our reasonable expectations were violated, but they refuse to link it to anything in the contract, that's the end of the story under the law of unambiguous contracts. I'd cite the court to the Burla and Frakes case, which say there's no cause of action in those circumstances. And this case never should have gone past the pleading.
Did you object to the jury instruction based on this argument?
Your Honor, what I did is I asked for an instruction that said words to the effect of complying with a contract is not a violation of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, which is taken black and white from Kentucky cases. And the district court judge, and we cite the transcript, said that's wrong. It's incorrect. And that's really indicative of the failure to ground what the trial was, or what any of these issues were about, in the contract. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Okay. Case is submitted.